Hey, sorry.
Hi Ruth, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Nice to meet you.
Good to see you. We're just setting up for the meeting here, so just give us about 5 minutes or so, and we'll be good to go, all right?
Yes, yeah, fine. Okay.
Thanks, brilliant. Cheers.
Hi Ruth, my name's Ben. I'm going to be chairing the thing.
Hi Ben.
Hi, hi. Can everyone hear okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I won't intimidate you, Ruth, by showing you all the faces behind the other way.
No, don't.
We're just waiting on Nick. So Gregor's gone to get him. So should be within the 5 minutes, yeah.
It's in the headlines.
Yeah. Oh, I was talking to you earlier at your stall, I think.
What?
I was talking to you earlier at your stall, I think.
Yes.
Part of the, yes.
Okay, sorry.
Blimey, full capacity.
Mm.
Yeah. There's room in the front.
Yeah, there's no four more seats.
There's room in the front here.
Yeah,
don't be shy.
Yeah.
Right, so it's 2:02 now, so I figure we get started. I'll just introduce the two speakers, and then Ruth, if you're okay to speak first, is that all right? Brilliant. So yeah, to introduce Ruth Kinna, she's a co-editor of the journal Anarchist Studies and an author of the Dog Section press pamphlet series, Great Anarchists. She's also a writer on Anarchic Agreements, a Field Guide to Collective Organizing from PM Press. Also the author of A Government of No One. You can find out more about her work at anarchyrules.info. She'll be talking about using Rudolf Walker's description of anarchism as the convergence of socialism and liberalism as a starting point to think about how anarchist values, think about anarchist values and movement building. Nick Heath has been an anarchist since 1966.
Oh dear.
And he's the author of The Idea and various other anarchist biographies.
600 of them all together, and you can find them on the LibCon site, www.libcon.org.
Brilliant. Yes. And he's also a member of the Anarchist Communist Group.
That's right.
So we'll get started. I'll open the floor up to Ruth there.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation. So I was asked to talk about movement building, and I suppose I sort of feel a bit like I'm teaching grandmother to suck eggs, but so I thought about this by trying to distinguish two sort of aspects. One is a kind of question about how we sustain anarchist associations or spaces or groups. And the other is how to build alliances with other movements that are not specifically anarchist. And what I want to do is to talk about the second of those. So how to build, or what's at stake when we think about building alliances. And, you know, forgive me for coming at it in a roundabout way by talking about Rudolf Rocker, but, you know, Rudolf Rocker, the labor organizer, writer, fondly remembered as the anarchist rabbi. But I think I like Rocker for lots of reasons, but I think he has a really interesting idea about anarchism's origins, its theoretical origins. And I think he gives us a sort of a really, I mean, maybe controversial, but an interesting sort of direction of travel. So I know Rocker is a well-known figure, but I'm going to say something about him just in case people aren't familiar with him. Then I'm going to talk about his description of anarchism as this conjunction of socialism and anarchism in order to try and unpack what he thinks the dilemmas of political engagement are in order to reflect on our own kind of predicaments. So just about Rocker, he's usually remembered as the author of Anarcho-Syndicalism and Nationalism and Culture. They're the things he's most famous for. But he also wrote Pioneers of American Freedom, which is an analysis of American individualist anarchism. He wrote a story in prison called The Six, which is about sort of human discovery and fellowship. He wrote two pamphlets about the Spanish Revolution, which look at the role of finance capital, state aggrandizement, and Soviet gangster terrorism in Spain. And he wrote his memoir, The London Years. So he was born in 1873. If anyone's interested in sending me a card, I share a birthday with him on the 25th of March. He was apprenticed as a bookbinder. He became a socialist in his teens. He was introduced to anarchism by de Mellen Nieuwenhuis, apologies to any Dutch speakers, who was a former Lutheran preacher and probably the foremost anti-militarist advocate of the general strike at the time. He settled in London in the 1890s, where he met Millie Whitcomb. She was an important activist in her own right. She was a Kropotkinian feminist, future pioneer of women's syndicalism. She also worked with Rocker in the East End of London in the labor campaigns that culminated in the 1912 Jewish tailors strike. In 1916, the Daily Mail, of all papers, described her as one of the best known women socialists in England, quite sympathetically. And she and Rocker were together for 58 years. So Rocker was interned in 1914 for, as he put it, the horrible crime of being a German. He settled in Berlin with Millie on his release in 1918, and they stayed until March 1934 when he escaped. He'd been put on a Gestapo hit list. And he sailed for New York the same year and remained there until his death in 1958. So in a sense, I mean, that's the background really to the controversy that Rocker provoked within the anarchist movement. Because in 1941, he published a pamphlet called The Order of the Hour, which is a short essay that called for the defense of liberalism against fascism. He argued that totalitarianism was a more likely prospect than revolution. And he rejected the anti-war view, which was prevailed in the anarchist movement, that Nazism was just another variant of capitalism. And he rejected the conclusion that was drawn from that anarchists could be indifferent about the outcome of that conflict. So this view was controversial, in his own terms, because it ran counter to the view that he expressed in the Spanish Revolution. And it triggered a rerun of the debates that had been provoked when Kropotkin came out developed his pro-war stance in 1914, which at that point Rocker had completely rejected. So I mention this, I mean, not because I'm interested in judging Rocker. I think, you know, the risk of judgment is partly that it conceals the problems that we're judging. And I think, you know, the reason I think it's important to sort of think about why he made the decision that he did is because it illustrates really dramatically what's at stake in thinking about engaging in anarchist politics in conditions that are not of anarchists making in really messy political contexts. So the question I want to think about is why he made the decision that he did. And I think the answer lies in the way in which he situated anarchism both within a left-right political spectrum, while also placing it outside that spectrum as an anti-nationalist, internationalist alternative to all competing isms. So on one hand, you can locate it within the left and the right, and on the other hand, you can locate anarchism as the critique of everything that's contained within that spectrum. So I don't think it's a particularly unusual view, but I think the way that he explains it, the way he sets it out is really helpful. So I'm going to say a bit more about his account of anarchism before then coming back to what I think the direction of travel is that he gives us. So the starting point comes in a statement that Rocker makes in Anarcho-Syndicalism. And this is a quote. He says, "In modern anarchism, we have the confluence of the two great currents which during and since the French Revolution have found such characteristic expression in the intellectual life of Europe, socialism and liberalism." So this statement is sometimes understood, I think, to mean that we can piece anarchism together by sort of cherry picking bits of liberalism and socialism that we might like and discarding the rest. So we could say anarchism is equality plus liberty, or it's classlessness without the dictatorship. And I think there's something in that, but I think that's not really what he meant. And I think what he wanted to argue is that this confluence means that anarchism changes the basic properties of both socialism and liberalism. So it's when we see these things through an anarchist lens that we can see their flaws. So I think he defended, I mean, the argument I'm going to make is that I think Rocker defended liberal values. So I think he defended free thought, free speech, free association, all of those things. But he subjected those what are presented to us normally as rights, to a socialist critique. So, for example, Rocker says that he was attracted to anarchism because of its emphasis the emphasis that anarchists laid on notions of initiative and self-help. And when you read that, I think it's quite striking because self-help in particular as a sort of an anarchist concept is really a bit confusing. I mean, Colin Ward says, you know, points out rightly, in my view, I mean, self-help has now become a kind of a byword for rampant individualism, for really what Goldman called rugged individualism. So it's preached as a virtue by the most powerful in order to urge sort of belt tightening and thrift on the most vulnerable and the poorest. But Rocker uses the term in a way, he takes it back from liberalism, if you like. And for him, he understands self-help as a practice of self-organizing, and it's rooted in mutual aid. So in a way, he uses the word self-help to describe what would now be called something like self-government or DIY politics. As a general principle, he says it means free agreement and solidarity and cooperation. And in labor activism, he says it self-help dovetails with the principle of workers' self-emancipation. So it's the idea of building from below and developing practices of self-government. So similarly, Rocker defines self-help in terms of individual autonomy. And he uses, he repeatedly, throughout nationalism and culture, he uses this phrase, man is the measure of all things. Unfortunate use of man, but you know, the individual is the measure of all things. But then he unpacks this and he says, the anarchist rendering of that idea is very different to the liberal one. Because in liberalism, the idea of individualism translates to a notion of separateness, to the concept of rights, which are guaranteed to each citizen to guarantee their sort of sphere of liberty. And Rocker says, well, you know, of course, you wouldn't have even had these rights had it not been for collective struggles. But even more so, he drives a wedge between the anarchist and the liberal concept, because he says, you know, when we think about autonomy, we're also thinking about what he calls personal responsibility. And the effect of introducing this concept is to detach emancipation, which is a collective thing, from an idea of personal liberation or individual liberation. And to stress instead, personal responsibility actually stresses the idea that we have responsibilities to each other. It's another take on mutual aid. We have responsibilities to our fellow beings. It's an ethical feeling that arises, he says, from human association. So unlike liberal freedom, when he thinks about protecting what he called, you know, what he thinks of as sort of liberal freedoms, he's not assuming the atomization that underpins liberalism. What he's thinking about is notions of sociability and notions of justice that we work out collectively through our practices and struggles. So when Rocker says anarchism is the confluence of liberalism and socialism, actually he has a particular idea of liberalism. And I think the essence of the argument, I mean, what he likes about liberalism is that liberalism embraces diversity, it embraces pluralism, it embraces voluntarism. And because we can understand, or I think Rocker's view is that because we can see these things in anarchism, we can also use those values and hold them up against other forms of socialism, equally in critique of those. So, and he has Marxism in mind here, and he says, if you support concepts of diversity, pluralism, voluntarism, then what you're doing is rejecting what he calls the police concept of freedom. This is the notion that vindicates despotism of freedom, the collective will over tyranny, and justifies revolutionary government. And he wants nothing to do with it. He supports the principles of class solidarity that he identifies also in Marxism, but he wholly rejects the implication that social solidarity can be achieved by homogenizing interests, either through the party or anything else. So I think that his conclusion is that when he thinks about, when he thinks about the relationship between anarchism and liberalism, he's also thinking about the way in which they diverge in terms of practices. So all of this is, I think, very familiar. So anarchism rejects liberal constitutionalism because liberal constitutions sanction property monopoly, exclusive rights to ownership. Liberal constitutionalism is predicated on an idea of monarchical government. So it's a hierarchical leadership principle, and it creates new forms of tyranny. He thinks liberals paid far too little attention to the everyday practice of freedom. So they wanted to de-emphasize, you know, what people were doing in their everyday lives politically in order to play up the role of the so-called great men of history, people who were deemed to be able to bend history to their will and deliver the good for everybody simply because of their personal virtues. So he really hated the idea that politics was best left up to representatives, to other people. And when he thought about America, he argued that liberals had failed to prevent the capture of government by corporate interests. They'd failed to counter the manipulation of electorates by scheming career politicians. They'd failed to resist the pressures of racist, xenophobic and misogynistic interests, organized particularly in bodies like the Ku Klux Klan and other reactionary groups. So these failures pointed up a basic deficiency in a liberal concept of power. And in short, I mean, liberals, he said, were kind of bewitched by the idea that freedom had already been achieved and that all we needed to do as liberals was ensure that we had strong and virtuous leaders who would, you know, arm themselves with the law in order to protect our rights. And he says that's a nonsense. So he's putting, I mean, you know, he's putting anarchism within a left-right framework. He's saying that there's a relationship between anarchism, socialism, and liberalism. But in making that argument, he's actually completely sort of redefining the core concepts as he sees them within both of those camps. So at the same time, he's also putting anarchism outside that left-right framework. He's saying actually anarchism is completely different to anything that we have in our mainstream politics. It stands outside as a critique of all the things that go on within that sphere. And this detachment, I think, or in making this detachment, in sort of saying anarchism also has a sort of a view above ideology, he defines anarchism as what he calls the will to freedom. And in this sense, this is the argument he puts in Nationalism and Culture. And he defines anarchism as the resistance to nationalism, or what he calls the will to power, borrowing Nietzsche's phrase. And he defines the will to power as the desire to bring everything under one rule. So this is a concept of statism. And he says, but it has different kinds of expressions. So in liberalism, this aspiration to the will to power is motivated by ideas of equality and justice, whereas in totalitarian regimes, by which he means Stalinism and fascism, the goal is just mere compliance. So from this perspective, liberalism and totalitarianism stand on the same line. They're both expressions of the same tendency, this nationalist statist tendency to homogenize and to dominate. The will to power. And I think the crux of his argument is that nationalism, I mean, well, the crux of his argument is that nationalism is parasitic on the state, but it's also integral to all of the things that liberalism then promotes as virtues. So citizenship rights, equally the duties that we have to the state, and on the darker side, you know, the way in which it identifies aliens, foreigners, outsiders. And he says religion, myth, shared history, common language, spurious race science, all fortify nationalism. They nurture divisions, you know, within our own communities and globally. They spawn colonial theories of origin and imperialist accounts of civilization. So anarchism is against all of that. And anarchy is the only way in which we can keep pushing what he calls the will to freedom. It's the antidote to the will to power. So I don't think I've said anything remarkable, or I don't think, you know, there's anything remarkable in Rocker's critique either of liberalism or the state. I think the ideas are all very familiar. I think the interesting thing about Rocker is the way in which he runs these two different conceptions of anarchism together. One, you know, inside the sort of the ideological framework and the other outside it. So in doing so, I think, you know, the sort of the really important thing that he does is that he's emphasizing the overlaps between anarchism and liberalism, whilst also warning about the vulnerability of liberal institutions by their own failures and weaknesses to the persistent threat of tyrannous, dictatorial and totalitarian forces. And that creates the dilemma for him. How do we respond to that as anarchists who are on the margins, which is where he thinks anarchists are, in terms of their numbers, in terms of their thinking? So I think these two different perspectives on anarchism explain his own apparent inconsistency. So his rejection of Kropotkin's pro-war stance in 1914, his lack of enthusiasm about the Bolshevik coup in 1917, and his support for the Allies in 1941. So in 1914, Rocker argues that anarchism is the bulwark against nationalism and therefore rejects the pro-war argument. In 1917 and 1941, what he does is he begins to emphasize anarchism's liberal sensibilities in order to forge a link, if you like, to democratic forces as the bastion against the manifestations of, or the strongest manifestations of European nationalism, which he thinks are Stalinism and Nazism. So he's obviously writing in a particular context, but it seems to me, I mean, I guess this is the point I want to make, that his concerns about the fragility of liberalism and liberal democracy and all of the things that we recognise as being deeply, deeply flawed have a real resonance in a period where we can see, you know, every day that there's sort of an increasing rightward shift of contemporary politics. And I think that raises, you know, alarm bells, or should have raised alarm bells. I mean, it doesn't mean to say we should follow Rocker's decision-making processes, but we have to take seriously the idea that we're engaged, you know, if we're thinking about movement building, then there's an engagement in politics that has to be made and which is difficult to make because of the dilemmas it presents. But I think, you know, I like the idea, I guess, that Rocker has one foot in the camp of institutional democracy and another foot outside of that camp. I think he's right to argue that there are good reasons to value the imperfect liberties that liberal democracy provides. But I think he's right to argue that liberal institutions are certainly not the best or only guarantors of liberal values, and I don't think liberals are even the best interpreters of liberal values. But by the same token, I think, you know, if we're thinking about movement building, then we have to think about the response that anarchists make to groups who want to smash liberalism, either of left or right, without distinguishing between the values that we might want to protect and the institutions that we don't think are very strong in providing that protection. So, you know, what does that mean about movement building? I think it means, you know, trying to find alliances with groups that are not necessarily specifically anarchist, but which are seeking to push liberalism in increasingly liberal directions, even if at the moment they don't see themselves as actors who want to challenge liberal institutions. It seems to me that's the conversation that has to be had, and they are the spaces within which anarchists can at least have a conversation about why liberalism is unable to protect itself and why anarchism is the best way in which you can really defend those freedoms, that autonomy, and that sense of ethics and personal responsibility that the Rocker identifies in the overlap between anarchism, socialism, and liberalism. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Ruth. I think we might have, say, 5 minutes for questions for Ruth, and then we'll move on to Nick.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yes, carry on.
So does anyone have any questions or thoughts? Yeah.
Just want to, I had a question about the last point that was made about trying to find alliances with not necessarily anarchist groups, essentially. This is going to sound ridiculous. Is platformism an option with non-anarchist groups?
Did you hear that, Ruth? Or
Is platformism an option?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not, so that's a, I don't see why, I mean, it depends what sort of, I mean, platformism, as I understand it, is a kind of a, is an unfinished project, right? You know, it's an ongoing project which has to lend itself to the context in which it finds it. So although it has, it prioritizes certain forms of oppression, particularly, I mean, you know, class oppressions. I don't think that platformism necessarily excludes other forms of oppression. I don't like the idea of shutting off forms of anarchism from other forms of anarchism or other forms of anti-oppression politics. I mean, that's where I come. And I guess, you know, the reason that I was talking about Rocca is because I think what he had to say about the predicament that he was in rings very true for the predicament that I think, or the way I understand contemporary politics now, that we're facing the same kinds of really vicious, really repressive politics. And, you know, that's the primary, that's the focus. That for me is the focus. So the question is not just about, you know, what kinds of, you know, whether you vote or not. It's not those things. It's who you can, whatever position you come from, who you can talk to. I don't think there should be one strategy, who you can talk to in order to build alliances against that rightward drift. That for me is the issue.
Yeah.
We maybe have time for one brief question. Yes, sir.
I think that both ideas that anarchists should make alliances with other forces, and the idea that within the liberal democracy there are different degrees of authoritarianism, they're both not new. Anarchists have always asserted both. I think the key point is, on what ground do we form these alliances, and on what ground do we try to make institutions better, so to speak? And the answer is, the ground is direct action. So we do that outside of institutions. So in a way, we try to make institutions better, again, in quotes, by fighting them, by struggling outside of them and against them. I think that's the key anarchist point. That's not negotiable.
Hmm. You have thoughts on that, Ruth?
Yeah, so I agree. I don't think I'm saying anything new. And I absolutely agree about the, you're situating yourself outside, but you're in doing that, you're also working with inside that political sphere, which is limiting, compromising, and really messy. So there are other groups that work outside political institutions. There are feminist groups, there are black groups, there are all kinds of groups that are fighting outside those institutions because they see those institutions as being problematic or oppressive, but they don't necessarily think of themselves as anarchist. Now, if there's no conversation to be had with those people about the extent to which, you know, liberal institutions can ever protect the things they're fighting for, I think anarchists are missing a trick. I'm not suggesting for a minute that you give up direct action or rethink that. I'm suggesting that those are the principles that's the point at which you start to talk to non-anarchists about other ways of doing politics. Because at the moment, the institutional framework is precarious and also unable to deliver for the people who think it can deliver for them. And that's the opportunity, it seems to me, to have the conversation.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll open up to Nick there now.
Do you mind if I stand up? Or
yeah, do what you want.
I like to flow. Yeah, speaking as a platformist, or rather a post-platformist, because I agree with Ruth that the platform is an unfinished project. I think what I'm going to place my talk on is my book, The Idea, which is a history of anarchist communism. And I'm going to work through certain themes within that book to show how we can actually build a movement. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Good, good, good. I might be, you know, perhaps at odds or coming from a different angle than Ruth is. So I want to go back to a book called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was written by a German judge called Paul Elsbacher back in 1900. And he named seven figures who he said were the key figures of anarchism. You know, so Bakunin was one of them, fine. Kropotkin was another, fine. And then he put in people like William Godwin, Max Stirner, Tolstoy, Proudhon, who's, it's arguable whether any of these people were really anarchists. And they never self-described as anarchists. Now this template, this became a template for following books on anarchism, like George Woodcock's book, James Joel's book, Roderick Kedward's book, and Peter Marshall's Demanding the Impossible. And, you know, so anarchism is stretched out to include all these figures. Like, the worst of these books is Demanding the Impossible, where, you know, people like Ayn Rand, you know, a champion of vicious individualism, people like Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, and so-called libertarians like Murray Rothbard are all included in this pantheon of anarchist figures. That's what's wrong with it. For me, anarchism as a movement emerged out of the growth of the working class, and it fully sprang out with the creation of the first international organization of the working class, the First International. And so for me, all this trying to pull in these other people is wrong. I think it's a movement that developed. I think that the ideas that developed were due to workers, mostly French and with some German workers, who were breaking with the ideas of Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who believed in mutualism, which is a form of market socialism. And so they were moving in a collectivist direction, and they evolved these ideas themselves. You know, it wasn't Bakunin who invented anarchism within the First International, just as it wasn't Marx who invented the concept of communism within the Communist League. These ideas have already been formulated. Communism had sort of developed within the proto-working class artisanal elements within the French Revolution, you know, around people like Gracchus, Babeuf, and Sylvain Maréchal. And they came to fruition. You know, the idea of communism emerged in the working class areas of Paris, at Belleville, which is a hilly district, working class district. They emerged in the 1830s and 1840s, and at first they took on an extremely authoritarian slant, you know, with people like Etienne Cabet, extremely rigid authoritarian idea of a communist society. But anarchist communism itself emerged from within the First International. They were a continuance of what Bakunin says. So they moved from collectivism to communism. So the idea was that instead of rejecting all the rigid structures of of people like Cabet, Weitling, and to a certain extent Marx, and developing a libertarian communism. And that was developed by people like de Maistre, and then people like Kropotkin took it on. So in my book, I talk about that. I think when anarchist communism emerged, it had a certain reaction to what had gone on inside the First International with the behaviour of Marx and his followers, you know, which led to the expulsion of the libertarians from the International and the creation of their own International, along with the other working class elements like the English trade unionists. And I think because they rejected what they saw, you know, as these forms of organisation, they turned in. I mean, that they created the idea of anarchist communism, which was a huge development. But at the same time, they looked towards informal networks of loose groups, looking in on themselves, not out towards the working class anymore. And this was partly rectified with the entry of anarchists into combative class organisations, unions like the CGT and in France, and later on, you know, the Italian anarchists into the syndicalist unions and so on. But with that came, it was a step forward in a lot of ways, you know, anarcho-syndicalism. But then there's a certain current developed which said, no, anarchists are superfluous, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with it. You know, syndicalism, revolutionary syndicalism, is a thing unto itself. And so they rejected the idea of specific organisation. So like, what I'm arguing throughout my book is about the struggle for specific anarchist organisation. And going back to the ideas of Bakunin. Bakunin wasn't an anarchist communist, he was an anarchist collectivist, but he had two main things. He talked about, a dual organisation, so working within mass movements, like the First International, and a specific group of dedicated revolutionary, you know, the specific organisation. And there's been a constant struggle to develop those ideas, to develop to develop specific organisations. I mean, you can see it here in Ireland with the birth and unfortunately the death of the Workers' Solidarity Movement. Unfortunate, and in many other countries in France, in Italy, in Bulgaria, Russia. And I think one of the things that brought it forward was the platform itself, which was put together by Ukrainian and Russian anarchists who were trying to learn from the mistakes of the Russian Revolution, where anarchism was defeated and outmaneuvered by an authoritarian rival, the Bolsheviks. So what I'm arguing for is you really, if you want to create a movement, you've got to look towards two things. You've got to look towards dual organisationalism. You've got to look towards the creation of a specific anarchist organisation, and you've got to look towards involvement in struggles, either within the workplace and or within the neighbourhoods and in various campaigns. And you've got to avoid things like insurrectionism, which looks towards riots and is extremely anti-organisational. You've got to steer away from the ideas of revolutionary syndicalism, which rejects the specific organisation. You've got to reject things like campism, which which takes sides, you know, anti-imperialism, you know, anything that is anti-US is okay. You've got to have a real internationalism, a real revolutionary anarchism that doesn't side with the different states, but takes the side of an international position on the side of the working class. That's what you've got to do. And you've got to avoid becoming ghettoized. You've got to look outwards. You've got to look towards creating a revolutionary culture and develop a revolutionary media. And you've got to not just be in Twitterland or in cyberspace. You've got to get out onto the streets again. You've got to be seen as a visible presence on the street. So your propaganda is seen on lampposts or on walls, and your propaganda is taken up by people. You know, when you're handing out propaganda in the streets, and you've got to be seen as an influence within the workplace. I think, you know, perhaps not so much in Ireland at the moment, but hopefully it will come. But I mean, throughout the world, the working class is reawakening. You see it in the struggles in America. You see it in struggles in Europe and all around the world. And the working class is reacting to the vicious attacks that are taking place. You know, I agree with Ruth, you know, that things are getting more nasty every day. In many countries, the center has vanished and things are radicalizing to the right. So what you've got to do is look for ways of creating that culture and creating that media and implanting yourself there's a current of Latin American anarchism called especifismo, which is about the specific organization, talking about social insertion, being involved in movements, you know, in mass struggles. That's the way forward, away from all of these things I've said. I'll include other things like lifestyleism as well. You know, you've really got to look outwards and stop being in the ghetto. And then once again, revolutionary anarchism can, I think, become a force again, because everything else has failed. Bolshevism, Leninism has failed, nationalism has failed, all the other ideologies have failed, and the only way out, as far as I can see, is a revolution that leads to a libertarian communist society. If we aren't to plunge down into war and barbarism, and much worse, you know, the actual end of the planet with environmental disaster, which is due to capitalism. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Okay. I suppose we can open up to questions just for Nick, and then maybe general questions after.
What stops the organisation becoming authoritarian if it has so many rules about what isn't permitted in terms of being anarchist?
Well, I mean, it doesn't really have rules, you know. I mean, anything that's put in place in the organisation is decided by the membership.
I mean, in terms of you saying you must reject, and then a laundry list of types of action anarchism that must be rejected, as in no... No insurrectionism, no lifestyleism, etc.
Well, you know, I think those things, you know, I've nothing against, you know, a lot of things associated with lifestyleism, you know, I practice them myself, you know, but as an ideology, I think it's this leads people down a blind alley. It's the same as insurrectionism, you know. I think that leads you nowhere. I mean, I've seen, you know, the insurrectionists seem to have fallen very quiet now that the working class is starting to reawaken. So maybe they'll start learning from, I hope so, you know, because some of them see themselves as anarchist communists, you know, I hope they start thinking about effective organisation. Yes.
So I'm going to have to phrase my question. I suppose it's from an environment background, so I'm kind of always, when we hear about workers' struggles, maybe I'm too pigeonholing myself in the understanding of what workers' struggles are, but I'm always kind of thinking of the broader definition of a worker as, say, like people you might even own in our modern concepts of ownership, as in they have the land, they farm the land, and they can sort of interior of the capitalism on this piece of land. It might be just at a very small scale, and that kind of sense of workers, I know they're working the land, but you know, how do you kind of bring all these different ideas of people who might be outside of the working systems and they're on social welfare? So you're not in theory working, might be working in your own communities, you know, we might be in PAYE employment as well, I usually tend to call it. So I'm just trying to kind of think of, you know, like there's a very good conference on, and that's on every January. It's called the Oxford Real Farming Conference.
Yes, sure.
Actually a farming conference. It's basically a social justice conference. And they really look at kind of movements around the world, and a lot of them might be on the surface seeing like a farmers movement, but they're really a movement of communities, because food and food growing is really central to life. So as an example, I suppose, of what we're kind of trying to draw the questions and bringing all these different challenges that you're showing together, and also the collapse of the environment, and sometimes that kind of, it's hard to bring all these things like from an environment background, all this kind of learning about this and getting involved in the year 2000, there was a lot more social justice minded, and then I felt over the kind of 2000s that moved very, kind of became very neoliberal, and that's very tragic. So I think bringing all these things back together is really essential.
No, I agree. I'm one of our members is doing a lot of work with it within some of these movements that you mentioned. So I agree. And my idea of the working class isn't narrow. It's the broad mass of the population. You know, people who have to sell their labour power, who are robbed of any, you know, of any rights, of any power, you know.
Any other questions?
Come on, don't be shy.
Or thoughts, comments, critiques? We may open it generally and include Ruth as well, if she's okay with that. Yeah. All processing.
I just add, you know, when I talk about this, you know, I'm talking about a revolutionary intersectionality as well. You know, that includes a critique of patriarchy and of racism, and these structures, you know, were incorporated into the capitalism. So in order to destroy patriarchy and racism, all of those things, and a host of other things as well, you've got to, you know, they're all supported and they're all intertwined. You've got to destroy the capitalist structure. That's what I'm saying. It's not a narrow thing. It's not about people in flat caps with bulging muscles, you know, welding hammers. No, it's not that at all, because, you know, that's long gone. You know, it's about the... It's about emancipating not just the mass of it's about emancipating the mass of the population. Someone had their hand up, I think.
I just wanted to say, look, you said that to destroy patriarchy and and racism, you have to destroy capitalism.
Yeah.
But isn't the reverse also true?
Yes, of course.
They're so intertwined that to really tackle those, we need to.
Oh, yeah.
And because capitalism. Yeah, because capitalism, really, they're pillars of capitalism. Capitalism depends on them to such an extent that you have to tackle those, or you end up with just another form of capitalism.
Oh, absolutely. Anyone else? Go on.
Yes.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, let's say in one country, a strong movement develops.
Yes.
There is a combination of a strong movement, like trade unions and a sympathetic government. Is it possible in a single country to go beyond capitalism? Because we see that every time that a left government is elected, we see sanctions and withdrawal of investment, you know? So is it possible to build it in just one country?
You can't. No, it's impossible to do that because it becomes isolated. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Please.
So you've got to start talking about, you know, I mean, it's in some ways it's made more and more possible by globalization, the chance of a world revolution. People look at struggles in one place and are inspired by that, and they, you know, they see what's going on in one place and they do it themselves in their own region. You know, it's all of that. Blues.
Question of I'm processing that idea that anarchism can be removed from that left and right continuum, and also kind of can be applied, if I understand, be applied as a like nearly political analysis or what's going on, and the certain sort of principles which could help alliances. Could you talk more about kind of that special place of anarchism, which is as well kind of looking outwards and inwards, and just a little bit more about it?
Is that a question?
I think that's aimed at Ruth, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
did you catch that, Ruth?
The sound was a bit funny.
Muted, sorry.
The speaker switched off.
Oh. Oh, dear.
Sorry, Ruth, one second.
Yeah.
There you are. Can you?
Yeah, so the sound was a bit odd, but so I think the question was about saying something about this relationship between inside and outside.
70% is fine. Sorry, Ruth.
I missed some of the question because the sound cut out, but cutting out. But, so it was saying something about inside and outside, that, you know, being within the sort of the framework of politics and yet having a perspective above it or outside it. Is that right?
Anarchism as that political analysis, which is kind of
removed
from that right and left, and therefore has that kind of advantage to look at all of that, this kind of slightly, and this critical view, then giving kind of more...
Yeah. Okay, I think I've got it. So I'm not sure I think that the critique that puts anarchism outside is basically the critique of the state, which Rocker presents as a critique of nationalism. And I'm not sure that that's an advantage. I think actually that can be quite paralyzing in a way, because, or reductive perhaps, it can encourage us to think in terms of, you know, everything, you know, we're against anarchism is against everything. And it's the critique that's often put to anarchists. It's the reductive critique that says, well, anarchists have got nothing to say about politics because they're anti-politics. And because it's that, you know, that in itself is a misunderstanding of the way I think that anarchists understand what political engagement is about. But it seems to me that I absolutely agree that movement building is also about how you sustain
anarchist organizations and groups, but it seems to me that the effort that anarchists make as anarchists is not to turn everybody into an anarchist. The effort is to try and change our institutional practices and our norms and the ways in which politics is framed by non-anarchists and make them more anarchistic. And that's a really hard thing to do because you have to convince people that the things that they consider to be ridiculous and impossible and utopian and all of those things are actually quite practical and entirely possible. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a gap between the kinds of politics that we have to engage with, holding our noses, if you like, because we don't identify with any of the institutional arrangements, and the kind of politics that we want. And if you recognize that gap, then you also have to recognize that most people that we're trying to work with don't share our views. So the idea is, rather than just say everything that goes on in the mainstream is fundamentally wrong because we're anti-statist, is to say, yeah, we're anti-statist, so how do we engage in politics? And how do we build those alliances? How do we, in order to propagate our view? So I would say, for example, there's a big crunch now in terms of the Ukrainian war. Where do we stand? Do we just say it's nothing to do with us? Or do we say, we recognize that that some of the struggle that's going on there is nationalistic and therefore we're not going to support it? Or do we say, well, we understand the complexity because we understand that one at the same time, there is a struggle which is nationalistic, and yet there's a struggle which is also deeply, deeply tyrannous. You're doing the same things at once. And so, how do you navigate that? And how do you put an anarchist view that contrasts with the sort of the mainstream liberal pro-NATO, pro-state, and try and present a different way of thinking about the issue of security? And unless you engage in those conversations, I think, you're forever going to put, anarchism will forever be on the margins. We have to work with the movements that are already there. And I think, to that extent, that is if you want to call it the working class, then they are the working class movements. Which of those can you work with? Which of those can you begin a dialogue with? And which of those can you begin to think about anti-oppression politics from an anarchist perspective with?
From my own perspective, when I get involved in movements, in totally like local community movements, I find that coming up, the movement gets great momentum at the start, it all looks very well, and we share ideas with our other comrades of different areas, different backgrounds, and then we run into an election year, and the anarchists stay anarchist, and the rest start running around with votes. And that, I think that for me personally, that damages my confidence in being able to be a part of those organizations, because if I'm isolated then further because of my own kind of beliefs and my own ideology. I just wonder how we manage to mitigate that or work against that, so we can keep that momentum or keep that sense of wanting to belong to that movement to get involved.
Either of you want to take that?
Well, I think at the moment our forces are very weak. Just have to look at what happened in the UK with Corbynism. And it was a repeat of something that had happened previously in the late 1980s, when a load of people had rallied to the Labour Party because of Tony Benn. There are all these groups that had grown up, hundreds of different groups that have grown up around women's liberation, gay liberation,
community groups. A lot of these got sucked into Benism, and the same thing happened with Corbynism. I mean, some people who call themselves anarchists actually went into the Labour Party, for God's sake. You know, it was appalling. And look how that ended, with a whimper, you know. That's what you've got to put up with. I mean, it is very dispirited, but we've got to, you know, just continue to plow, you know, to work away doggedly and determinedly until, you know, we can get a bit more traction. But we've got to be aware of all of these things. They're all there to co-opt movements back into the system. You know, and these ideas of recuperation and co-option, these mechanisms are extremely strong. And we've got to, you know, develop people's consciousnesses so they don't fall into these traps again and again. You know, they don't fall into these traps of relying on social democracy. You cannot rely on social democracy. You see where it goes. I mean, now the Labour Party is moving even further to the right after the Corbyn experiment. And those forces that coalesce around Corbyn are totally demoralised. A lot of them have given up as well. So you've got to be very aware of those processes.
So I agree with that. So yeah. what I'm not suggesting that, you know, the choices between taking part in liberal democratic institutions or not taking part in liberal democratic institutions. What I'm suggesting is that when we come to election times, actually, you know, there are thousands, millions of people who are simply not engaged in this anymore, particularly under 25. Yeah. They're the people that you talk to. You know, it's not a matter of trying to convert someone who wants to vote. You know, if they want to vote, then, you know, okay, whatever, you know. But the conversation is to be had with people who are disaffected and who may just think, you know, that disaffection and apathy, you know, are one and the same thing. And, you know, being disaffected is actually, you know, part of that's the springboard, isn't it? For thinking about different ways of engaging. That's my point.
Well, I agree.
There was a few years ago, we did, I'll say,
Sonia, you go ahead. It'll be next.
Just a quick point. A few years ago, we'd political elections here, and people went into the ballot papers deliberately and voted for Dustin the Turkey, who's a personality on television. And it's kind of their way of registering their basically their dislike or their anger at the people who are voting, but also just saying we're using this process to show our disdain in this process. And they actually realised, they actually counted the number of votes that Dustin the Turkey got. So just as a mechanism, is that, you know, do you see this kind of a place in doing that? If you don't go into the ballot paper, then you're seen as completely not in the system. But is there a way of using the system to kind of F with the system?
Lord
Buckethead is actually stands as a, you know, right. The Dustin the Turkey wasn't actually a candidate, so it is running in the pub. But enough people did it.
So a question at the back there.
Can I ask, well, thanks to Nick, Ruth, well, I'd like to know, what you're talking about, you seem to be talking about movement building in terms of, that's what you're talking about. And is there efforts at that in the UK? Obviously, we're all very aware of the absolute shit show that was Brexit. And that seems to be, in the recent elections, we see that people are going back to the Labour Party, but nobody has any fucking belief in the Labour Party either. So, is the movement actually growing? Is there efforts to grow the movement in terms of bringing our politics out there to the massively disillusioned.
But,
because, you know, that's kind of really where we're at. And also, it's not funny for us to laugh about people anarchists being in the Labour Party, because here there's a lot of people who actually are going to Sinn Féin with the same ideas that So, you know, the joke's on us. So anyway, that's the question. I'd like to know about efforts around
Britain,
because
well,
I think that that's precisely what we need here.
I'd say there is no anarchist movement in Britain. There's an anarchist scene, and I don't think I've seen the anarchist scene in such a diabolical state as now. Not for a very long time, anyway. And I've been through a lot of changes, you know. But I hope things will change as, you know, we've had as you also know, we've had a lot of strikes in Britain, and I think a lot of them, well, practically all of them will be sold out by the union bureaucrats, but I think the process has raised class consciousness, and hopefully we'll see the results of that, you know. It's a pretty diabolical state in the UK at the moment, you know, extremely bad. But, you know, you still have to live in hope that you can create something out of this mess. I think I've been blunt, being very frank about things in the UK. It's not looking that good, you know.
Ruth, do you have any thoughts on that?
So, I guess it partly depends on what we consider to be a movement, on the, or the difference between a movement and a scene. There are things that are going on. There are publishing ventures. I think Dope magazine does a fantastic job of not only of practicing anarchism, but also propagating anarchist ideas. I think, you know, there are education efforts. There are all sorts of people who are sort of trying in their small ways to think about, you know, how they can change the practices where they are to make them more supportive, more solidaristic, you know, to support mutual aid. I agree that there's a concerted sort of joined up sense of, you know, this is how we're going to build anarchism. I think that's probably right. But as I say, I think, the spaces are there. I mean, the spaces are there both in some green politics. The spaces are there in movements towards decentralisation. Certainly the movements are there, or the spaces are there in terms of rethinking agricultural policy and some of the stuff that's going on there. That there are co-ops. There are all of these things. So I just think, you know, we have to work with what's there and try and sustain it, and to keep pushing the messages and finding the opportunities to change the political scene. I mean, that seems to me to be the sort of the way that you can do things the real devil is the possibility of demoralization and burnout. And you have to think about, you know, what you can do and how you can support people who are trying to do different things. That seems to me to be the way that you build movements.
Yeah. So just to say, I'm aware that we're a bit over time here. It's 6:10. There's no thing ongoing after this one. So if we go a bit over time, I suppose, you know, people are free to leave if they need to go. But we'll continue on with the questions until we run out of steam, I guess.
You've got about four people.
Yeah. The first hand I saw was Gregor's there.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that last question in terms of, I think Ruth's point about, I suppose,
We have to work with what's there and find what's there and try and build from that point. There's not much we're trying to look for something that doesn't exist as our starting point. Our starting point is where things are at and where movement building is or isn't. And there isn't a huge net, and there's a huge gap here, obviously, in Ireland, in terms of organised anarchism. And yet there's a huge opportunity because there are a lot of young people getting interested in the idea, coming at it from a lot of different perspectives, maybe. And so their challenge would be, how do we draw people together and build some sort of movement out of that? So as the follow on from Dermot's question, I suppose, when he said in terms of where's movement building in the UK, not in a great place. Are there other organizations in other parts of the world that you would point to as examples of, that we could look to? I mean, for example, we had at the meeting earlier on, the anti-imperialism meeting, very great talk about Rojava, what's going on there. So there are other parts of the world, or there are places that you would point us to in terms of looking for example of how movements can be built, either from the past or from now.
Well, I think to a certain, can I answer this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, you know, in Latin America, where they have applied this especificismo, I can never pronounce it properly, especificismo tactic of social insertion, that has had some results, you know, within, so, you know, a specific people from a specific, well, like specific organisation working within a larger grouping, things like that. Yeah? Does that answer you?
Yeah, are there specific organisations that you would point to say these people seem to be getting it right? And are there specific...
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose in France, really, you know, there's the Union Communist Libertaire, which has 600 members, and there's the Fédération Anarchiste as well, you know, which has its own radio station and quite a few bookshops around the country, you know, things like that, you know. I mean, it's not ideal, and, you know, they're up against a very large far-right movement, you know, and the neoliberalism of... Macron, but you know, they're relating to a situation which saw vast numbers of people come out on the street, you know, and they are trying to relate to that. You know, millions came out on the street in the recent disturbance and are continuing to do so. You know, it's not guaranteed that you will be able to push this pension law through, you know. It's not completely guaranteed, you know.
There's a group that had a beer campusina, just like a kind of conversation with the silence with the beer campusina.
Ruth, do you have any specific organizations you'd have in mind for what you're talking about?
So I don't know about specific organisations, but I mean, I guess I would point to things like the movements in Catalonia recently, which anarchists were involved with some of the, you know, the separatists. So I think that was an important moment for anarchists there. I think there's a lot of activity going on in Canada. Between anarchist and indigenous peoples organisations, particularly against the corporations. I think that's a really important movement. And there was there are examples of, I mean, big student movements, which were also involved anarchists in Quebec in the last few years. So, I mean, you know, there are lots of these sort of connections. There are really, really powerful overlaps between black rights movements and anarchist movements. And these really sort of bore fruit, it seems to me, against Trump. So, you know, but I'm not sure that, I mean, you know, I guess that the issue then is how you how you, well, even things like, you know, during the pandemic, you know, the sudden mushrooming of mutual aid groups, and, you know, they're by no means all anarchists, but some of them were. And, you know, there's a cross-fertilization of ideas. And I guess, you know, the question that raises then is how you sustain the energy that arises in these moments and through these alliances and through these shared projects, how you sustain that in order to, you know, over time and in order to bring more people in and to actually change, you know, local community practices or however it is you're working. That's the trick. And I don't think we've quite sort of answered that, but it seems to me that would be a really sort of fertile ground to look at, to investigate.
Thank you. So yeah, just as people are starting to filter out, I think the book fair officially ended 15 minutes ago. So I'll just say, you know, I believe we've all had, you know, a really brilliant time today, or hopefully people have. And yeah, just say that, you know, it unfortunately costs money to, you know, have this all set up. So if you haven't already donated, please consider donating to the funding of the book fair. That was that. So any more questions? Yeah, miss. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for your answer. Every time I listen about the conversation about the importance of education and communication in anarchism, I always have in mind the concept of cultural hegemony by Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci, that of course is not compatible with anarchism because of the conception of power that it includes. But then I wonder whether it would be possible and it would be interesting to operate a sort of anarchist deconstruction and reconstruction of the notion of cultural hegemony, and what kind of new practices would that suggest?
Did you get that, Ruth?
Yeah, gosh, that's a that's a nice question. So I'm not sure that hegemony is exclusively, I mean, Gramsci sort of takes it over. I mean, it becomes really associated with Gramsci, but there's an essay by Elise Reclus talking about hegemony in Europe, and he uses it to describe, you know, processes of European colonization and to explain why they, how and why they come about through, you know, his kind of geographical lens. So, I mean, I think, you know, all of these terms are there for the taking. And it seems to me that it's really important to think about how differently, you know, these different kinds of meanings these terms take on, you know, how we contest these terms in otherwise. I mean, ideas matter, I think. They really matter. So the way that you can, you know, push anarchist messages is actually to use common languages, but just show how, you know, maybe the existing definitions don't quite do what you want them to do in terms of other values and goals. You know, so, you know, a Gramscian concept of hegemony for me doesn't really deliver the kinds of freedoms that you'd want socialism to deliver, and having that argument is all part and parcel of how you change people's ways of thinking. So I think it's really, really important that we do that.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
I think you're probably right that Nick is right that like anarchism is kind of at quite a low end. In the English-speaking world, in Britain and Ireland, in North America, the at the same time, the idea of abolition has gained a lot of ground and is very popular. And I think that like abolition, if you take it seriously, and a lot of the people who propose prison abolition, a lot of people who talk about prison abolition, like it really implies anarchism, or more or less, you know. And is there a way that we can be active in those things and, you know, argue for abolition or reconnect that to the word anarchism and through that? Like, because I mean, I find it strange that there are people who call them, who say they're in favour of prison abolition, but they also subscribe to an authoritarian socialist ideology, for example. And I don't understand how they don't see the disconnect in that, but like, is there a way that we, that, you know, is there some fertile ground there for promoting our ideas?
Seems a good Ruth question.
Just very quickly. I agree. I'm an abolitionist. I'm a prison abolitionist, and I think, again, you know, it's very easy to knock the anarchist on the grounds of abolition, to say, oh well, you know, all you want to do is sort of make people insecure because you're going to sort of just let killers on the loose. You know, the arguments for prison abolition are so compelling, but what we're talking about is not just it's not the institutions of prison. It's the concepts of crime and how they're, you know, how they're perpetuated in ways which are, you know, really destructive. And it involves all kinds of other ways of thinking about our responsibilities to each other, not abdicating that responsibility to third parties who are just going to sort of take away somehow the bad people. And we don't have to think about the conditions in which they're kept. We don't have to think about anything because we've devolved our responsibility to an authority. You know, that's fundamentally wrong. And it means that we're just washing our hands of the problems that we need to take responsibility for. And I think that's exactly what Rocker was saying when he talked about responsibility and autonomy. Those things are so important, because, and there are abolitionist movements which are non-anarchist, which kind of, as you say, they kind of stop halfway. And they're essentially reformist. But at least they're using the term, and at least we can also use the term with real confidence, because, you know, it's deeply ingrained in anarchism, and show, you know, when you push it to its logical conclusion, what the implications of that are. And it's not just one institution. It means, you know, actually tackling an awful lot of other practices and norms, which explain why we still have prisons.
Yeah, I agree. We've got to engage with things like prison abolition. But I mean, there's other things as well, you know, the abolition of the police, which has become quite widespread as an idea in the United States and to a lesser extent in the United Kingdom. I'm ignorant of the situation in the Republic. The things like that. I mean, we've always said that we've got to get rid of the police, you know, and now more and more people are taking it out. When you think about it, some of our watchwords have now become common currency. Direct action was the first of those. You know, it was only the anarchists and syndicalists who talked about direct action, talking about, you know, action that avoided parliament in direct action, that sort of thing. Now, more and more people have taken that up over the last few decades within the environmental movement, blah blah blah, and then also this other work, one of our other watchwords, mutual aid, and we saw that in the recent COVID crisis with all this mushrooming of mutual aid groups all around. I don't know. Did they happen here in the Republic?
Not to the same extent.
Not so much as they did in the UK. I mean, these are things, you know, that would have gladdened the heart of Kropotkin, you know, who developed the idea of mutual aid. So, you know, I think our propaganda does have an effect. You know, we've been at it for a couple of centuries now, but they're becoming more widespread. You know, those things like that. You know, I think it's a huge opening up. We're talking about prison abolition and about abolition of the police. You know, I think that really is opening up some opportunities for us. So yes.
If you look at a snapshot of the prison population anyway, and you know, the Penal Reform Trust in Ireland and in the UK, they take snapshots of who's actually incarcerated at any moment in time. And it's not the people who, you know, when you're arguing a case for a prison, it's not, they're not actually the people most time you've been incarcerated. When you look, if you look at the snapshots, you go to the Irish Prison Service website, you actually look at who they're incarcerated, who's in custody. It's not like, you know, murderers, serial killers, you know what I mean? That's actually, you know, a tiny percentage of the actual prison population. Mm. And you look at who actually is in prisons and look at the length of the sentences that are imposed. And you look at, like, the rates of, say, what we consider to be violent crime, the rates of people, you know, cases that even go before the DPP even takes the case. Like, rape was the way of that, but, like, we've one of the lowest rates of those cases even making it to court in this country, and then even lower rate of people actually getting incarcerated who go through that system, and you're looking at 10 to 6 years, even if cases do go before the courts. So you look at actually who is in prison, it's not what, like what we think of as violent criminals. As, so the system is just, I talk about this a lot. But anyway,
so I guess I should ask Nick and Ruth, are you okay to go on any longer, or
do you... if people want us to go on longer,
what do you think?
Nodding off.
I'm gonna have to go by 8:30. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I'm really sorry, but I mean, really enjoying the conversation. But
so yeah. It's probably a good time to call it there now, since it's just about 8:30 now. And I suppose if people want to talk to Nick, he's here physically. So
I'm here physically. Yeah, I think.
Okay, so I just want to say thank you so much to Ruth and Nick for speaking today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Brilliant. So, Ruth, we'll let you go.
That's all right. Well, thanks very much for the invitation again. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, next time, hopefully, I'll make it over to Dublin.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye now.